Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us for what I'm certain will be a great discussion on Congress and trade. I'm Nate Kazmarek, the director of the Federal Society's Article I Initiative. We're pleased to be here in Longworth and particularly in this magnificent hearing room. We want to thank Chairman Brady and the Ways and Means Committee staff for their kindness in hosting us today. I also want to acknowledge my colleague, Pete Bisbee, who is director of the State Courts for the Federal Society and runs our Capitol Hill chapter, as well as the Capitol Hill chapter, for their kindness in co-sponsoring this event. Before I introduce our panel, I just want to give another quick plug for our Article I Initiative second annual writing contest. You may have seen a flyer out on the table outside. The theme this year is Ambition Counteracting Ambition, Enduring Principle or Failed Experiment. The deadline is not until January 7th, so you all have ample time to put pen to paper and offer your submission. For more information on that writing contest, you can visit fedsoc.org/AI contest. Turning to our panel, I think we've gathered a great group of experts. Full bios for each of them have been provided to you on our website and emails for this event, so I will give you shortened versions right now. Our moderator today is Molly Fromm. She is the General Counsel and Parliamentarian for the Financial Services Committee here in the House. She previously served as General Counsel and Parliamentarian for the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, and as Deputy General Counsel and Parliamentarian for the Oversight and Government Reform Committee. She received her BA in political science from the University of California, Berkeley, and her law degree from Catholic University of America, Columbus School of Law. We also have with us Brian Pomper, who is a partner at Akin Gump. He formerly served as Chief International Trade Counsel to Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus. He teaches international trade policy and politics at George Washington's Graduate School of Political Management. He was previously elected as a member of the steering committee for the International Law Section of the DC Bar. Brian has a Bachelor of Science from MIT and a JD from Cornell Law School. Next, we have with us Daniel McCarthy, who is editor of Modern Age. Previously, he was the editor at large of the American Conservative from 2010 to 2016. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, USA Today, The Spectre, The National Interest, Reason, and other publications. Dan is a graduate of Washington University in St. Louis, where he studied classics. Last but not least, we have Stephen Clays, who is a partner at Wiley Rhine. He previously served as trade counsel for the House Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade. Before that, as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for Anti-Dumping, Countervailing, Duty Operations at the U.S. Department of Commerce Import Administration, and as Special Advisor on National Security Affairs in the White House, Office of the Vice President. He received his BA from Notre Dame and his JD from Northwestern. Before we start, a reminder to all of you in the audience, we will have ample time at the end for Q&A, so as the speakers are speaking, please think of the questions you'd like to ask our panel. And with that, I'll turn the panel over to Molly.
Thank you, Nate. I think we'll just get started with our panelists. Brian, will you start us off?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks, I appreciate it. So now you can hear me. So I thought I would just give a little bit of a background for constitutional prerogative to Congress over international trade and how we got to where we are today. Some of you have heard this little speech already, so forgive me. As I think everybody knows, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution gives to Congress pretty clearly the power to regulate commerce among foreign nations. Article 2 gives to the president the power to negotiate treaties. And that is really the interplay that I think defines how the Congress and the president have dealt with trade policy over the years. Many of you may know, for the first maybe 150 years of our country, there was no topic that got more debate in the Congress and no one topic that filled more texts in the congressional record than the tariff. How high the tariff should be, how low it should be, where it should be allocated. Different parts of the country were impacted by different tariffs that were impacted. This was truly the number one thing that Congress was engaged in throughout the first 150 years of our history, culminating, perhaps most infamously, with the, I think the official name is the Trade and Tariff Act of 1930. Is that the correct title? More commonly known as the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which is really the last time that Congress passed a general tariff law. In 1930, we passed that law. It is largely thought to have deepened the Depression. And in 1934, the then administration of Franklin Roosevelt decided to, thought that that was a very bad thing, that the tariffs that we imposed in 1930 had really helped plummet world trade, had made the U.S. economy worse, and they thought, well, we need to deal with this matter. We, the administration, need to figure out how to lower these tariffs. How do we do that? And a brilliant guy who I don't think gets enough credit in U.S. history, named Cordell Hull, who was the Secretary of State for FDR, came up with the idea and understood that, well, we can't unilaterally lower tariffs in the United States. That's just politically infeasible. What we can do, though, is if we are engaged in a negotiation with another country and we lower tariffs as a result of that negotiation on a bilateral basis, because of the MFN, most favored nation, concept, we would thereby, in negotiating with one country, lower our tariffs with respect to all countries in the world. And we can do that on a line-by-line basis. And the law that they came up with, because, of course, Congress has constitutional authority over trade, was something called the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act of 1934. Also, I think, a totally underappreciated, landmark, revolutionary piece of legislation that delegated the authority to the president from Congress over trade policy. And it basically, the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act said, Mr. President, you can go out and negotiate trade agreements that will lower tariffs up to a certain amount. It was 50% in 1934. And as long as you negotiate tariff agreements that lower tariffs by no more than that, you can lower tariffs by proclamation. You don't have to bring the negotiation back to us for implementation. That is how trade policy worked for many, many years. It's how the United States negotiated the general agreements on tariffs and trade. It's how we negotiated many of the subsequent rounds of GATT negotiations was on the basis of this architecture, a delegation of authority from the Congress to the president to negotiate tariff lowerings up to a certain amount. That worked great when trade negotiations were solely about tariffs. Starting in the 1960s, trade negotiations started to be about other matters, non-tariff barriers, things like what kind of market access restrictions on services are put into place, what kind of intellectual property protections, how do you regulate your trade remedy actions. And in fact, in the negotiations, when the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act, it had been renewed numerous times. Coming up into the Nixon administration, as we were engaging in the Tokyo round of negotiations, multilateral negotiations in the 1970s, President Nixon proposed to Congress, listen, trade agreements aren't so much about tariffs anymore, certainly tariffs, but other things as well. Why don't you, Congress, give to me advance authority to rewrite the laws in order to meet the negotiations that I engage in? So basically giving the president the power actually to change U.S. law, not just the lower tariffs. You can imagine Congress at the time wasn't too enthused about that particular format. And thankfully, there were very strong members of Congress who said, no, actually, Congress writes the laws. And so ultimately, through a course of the negotiation, what the leaders in the Congress, the architecture they came up with for trade policy negotiations going forward was to say, okay, Mr. President, what we're going to do is we're going to write a bill, and it's going to delegate to you the authority to negotiate these trade agreements, going to delegate our constitutional authority to you. What we're going to do is we're going to provide guidelines for you. Here's the kind of agreement we want you to negotiate. And if, as long as you're willing to negotiate an agreement that falls within those guidelines, we will take up that agreement and we will pass a bill to implement that agreement without amendment, and we'll do it within a limited period of time. And those latter two were really requirements on the basis of experience the Johnson administration had negotiating some agreements with our some foreign countries that Congress didn't like and didn't pass. And big egg on the face of the administration, countries looked at the administration and said, well, how can we negotiate with you when we don't know that you're actually going to be able to pass this thing? We can't give you our bottom lines in negotiations if Congress is going to come back and ask for more. So in 1974, we came up with this process, then called fast track process, now called Trade Promotion Authority, whereby Congress tells the administration through what are called principal negotiating objectives. You gotta negotiate agreements that lower tariffs. You gotta negotiate agreements that open market access. You gotta negotiate agreements that have standards of protection for intellectual property that reflect the standards in US law. These kinds of guidelines that Congress tells the administration, negotiate like this, and if you negotiate like that, and you bring back an agreement that more or less falls in those guardrails, we'll pass it in a limited period of time without amendment. I think that process has worked quite well over the years, and I think power has shifted back and forth between the legislative branch and the congressional branch. I am told before my time in the early 2000s that Congress actually largely would have the pen and write the implementing text for these trade agreements. That shifted by the time I was up here, where we would work with the administration in crafting the actual text of the agreement, and then they would submit it through this whole mock markup process that many of you may know, but it essentially is something of a negotiation with the Committees on Ways and Means and Senate Finance. And that process has led to changes in implementing legislation at times. I know in the Australia free trade, we did that. The administration didn't want to include something on beef safeguard because Australia's a big beef producer. They didn't want to do that, but Senate Finance in particular spoke on the matter and it was included in the ultimate implementing text. There have been other, so that's an example of Congress actually asserting its will over the administration. In, I think, the Oman free trade agreement, there was a provision on child labor that was adopted in the Senate Finance mock markup that didn't make it into the final text. And the administration chose to ignore that. So there's been this push and pull over, you know, how much does Congress assert its constitutional authority over international trade in these trade negotiations? Can't have 535 negotiators. You got to have one focal point. I think this architecture makes sense. The question now, I think we find ourselves, and I don't mean this to be partisan or critical in any way, but I do think that the lessons of the last year and a half or so in this administration have caused people like me and other trade policy thinkers to wonder if Congress shouldn't be thinking about taking back some authority or reasserting some stronger guidelines over how the administration deals with trade policy, in particular in things like, well, we tell the administration what kind of agreements to negotiate when we get into free trade agreements. Congress hasn't provided any guidelines for when the administration can get out of trade agreements. What about using things like national security as a tool for imposing tariffs? These are things that obviously we have seen that are relatively unique, and I think it is a fair question to ask from the congressional side. Is the administration executing a trade policy that is consistent with what we as the constitutional guardians over trade policy would want? And if not, what are the tools that we have to try to course correct? So with that, I will turn it to my fellow panelists.
Well, thank you very much, Brian.
Your thoughts and your outline of some of the legislative history there segues very nicely into the remarks I want to deliver, which are going to talk about the political side of these questions, and even a little bit of the philosophical side, which I think is in fact important as we reconsider the policies themselves. As far as the politics is concerned, my suspicion is that if you did have Congress reclaim a greater role in trade policy, what you would actually find is that this would work to the advantage of critics of free trade. So right now, the fact that Donald Trump is implementing numerous tariffs and is generally revising the free trade regime that has been in place for the last 20 or 25 years is something that has prompted a number of critics of the administration and its policies to say, well, we think that Congress would be an effective check on you if Congress were to take a larger role in this. But in fact, I think in the long run, the opposite would be the case, that Congress, to the extent that it is open to a greater degree of deliberation, a greater number of viewpoints and political interests, would in fact slow down free trade agreements and would complicate their passage. And this, we can look at the political history of our free trade regime, and this tends to support that. You've heard a little bit about fast-track authority in the 1970s. Basically, between the New Deal, and Brian is quite right that, the sense that the Smoot-Hawley tariff may have exacerbated the Great Depression was sort of the first thing that contributed to the accumulation of trade powers in the presidency, that Congress delegated these powers because they thought, okay, this is a problem, and it's going to take, a single voice, a unitary negotiator in order to solve these problems in the future, working with other countries. So with the Great Depression, you could see why power concentrated in the president there with the view that he would pursue greater free trade. You could see why, throughout the period from World War II until the 1970s, that continued apace. The United States enjoyed such a tremendous advantage in terms of its industrial output over any potential rival, including our allies, that free trade was something that enjoyed a tremendous popular consensus. And it was something that, we were willing to sacrifice a little bit, perhaps, of our own sort of lead over other countries because we had a very strong strategic interest in seeing the reindustrialization of West Germany and Japan and generally of Western Europe. Going into the 1980s, however, you could see that we suddenly had a really serious industrial rival. We were actually getting serious industrial rivalry from West Germany as well, but Japan was particularly controversial, politically speaking, and was seen as being very effective at sort of out-negotiating us and using their Ministry of International Trade and Industry to pursue basically industrial policies that were strengthening their industry and weakening ours. And this erupted as a major political controversy in 1992. It was one of the things that fueled Patrick Buchanan's challenge to George H.W. Bush in the Republican primaries of that year. It was one of the things also that was fueling the Ross Perot independent presidential bid in 1992. So at that point, in the early 1990s, trade was becoming a very politically controversial subject. And this continued on further into the decade, where there was not only someone like Pat Buchanan, who remained a figure in Republican politics, but you had numerous Democrats as well, people like Richard Gephardt and David Bonnier, who were quite skeptical of the free trade regime as well. And so there was a tendency to look to Bill Clinton as being the counterforce to this. And the thought was that if you gave him sort of further negotiating powers and concentrated in the executive branch the ability to negotiate trade agreements, that this would be the best way, the most expeditious way to get free trade on the books. That if you involved Congress to a greater extent, you would have various factions and interests working to slow down the entire process. And this continued apace into the first part of the 21st century as well. But with Donald Trump, we've suddenly seen that there's a reversal, that Trump is now far less favorable towards free trade than previous presidents have been, and he may be less favorable towards free trade than Congress presently is. And that creates the impression that perhaps now we need to rein in the powers of the president in these negotiations and give Congress a greater say. But again, I think if you look back to the 1990s, you would see there was a reason why Congress was eager to delegate these powers and to keep them in the hands of the executive branch. Because if you start to involve Congress, if you start to open up more debates on trade within Congress itself, you're going to have the various interests that are adversely affected by world trade, adversely affected by competition from China or other major players in the world, having a strong voice in policymaking there. And that's going to complicate free trade negotiations and the acceptance of free trade. Now, I want to say a few words about a general philosophical problem here. The fact that there is an admixture of executive and legislative power involved in creating free trade agreements is, it's not legally a problem. It's not really a problem, constitutionally speaking, that trade agreements are not treaties. We can see how, you know, both the executive and Congress are, you know, fulfilling at least the letter of the law, the letter of the Constitution in terms of their powers where these agreements are concerned. But, you know, the concern here is not just one of constitutionality. And even if we bracket that, put that aside and say that's not a problem, there is a problem in terms of democratic legitimacy and political legitimacy. Normally, when it comes to legislation as complex as modern trade agreements in fact are, and as Brian mentioned, these agreements are not just about tariff levels and, you know, the sort of competitive industrial elements of a national economy vis-a-vis some other national economies. They're also agreements that, you know, affect labor law. There are agreements that affect intellectual property, environmental policy, any number of other things. Normally, when you have legislation this complex, you would expect it to be subject to a very high degree of democratic deliberation. That, you know, our whole model of government is based upon the idea that we not only have elected representatives, but these elected representatives speak for a variety of different interests. And they have very open-ended processes, you know, somewhat regulated by the internal rules of the House and the Senate, in terms of how they go about conducting their deliberations and coming up with policies that are the result of extensive compromise. This is the nature of legislation. Well, you can't really do that, of course, when it comes to international negotiations, because there you do not have a world legislature. There you do not have a world public that can openly deliberate these things and come to a world consensus. Instead, the best you can do is to have the executives, the heads of state of the various different interests that may be involved, the various different countries, come together and, you know, come up with something that works among themselves. But this doesn't have the same degree of democratic legitimacy that comes to, that you receive from a normal legislative process within a country. And I think this is one of the sort of key weaknesses of the free trade regime that has existed certainly over the last quarter century, and in fact, as Brian has mentioned, going back perhaps 70 years or more. That, you know, under the conditions of the Great Depression, under the conditions of the Cold War, and you know, into you know, the late 1980s, you had enough of a consensus among the elites, and you had enough of a sense of prosperity and pride in our industry and industrial leadership on the part of the American public, that you could have a free trade regime built up that did not involve the degree of controversy we've seen more recently. But with the rise of first Japan, and now to a much, much greater extent, People's Republic of China, these have become really intense political questions again. And, you know, as with any kind of political question this intense, there should be a political process to deal with it. And that means open deliberation. That means, you know, if legislation is going to be produced, it should be legislation that's produced through deliberation and not simply through the rather constrained limits imposed by the TPA and, you know, by fast-track authority. So it seems to me that, you know, the case for greater congressional involvement in trade negotiation and in trade policy over the long run will, in fact, tend not towards expediting free trade agreements. It will repoliticize trade, which is appropriate considering that trade is something that, you know, people feel very strongly about. It affects millions of Americans' jobs. It will repoliticize trade and get, you know, tend to put a brake on trade agreements and tend to, you know, make trade more like the, you know, standard legislative process here in the United States. And actually, of course, that process itself is not working optimally right now. So really, I think Donald Trump and critics of the free trade regime will actually win rather than lose to the extent that this is given more to Congress. Thank you.
Okay, well, as being the last person, it's hard to plan what you're going to talk about until you hear what your fellow panelists are going to say. And both of them did a great job in covering various issues. Well, first of all, just want to make clear that these views are my own views and not reflect the views of Wally Ryan or, you know, our clients. And also, it's great to be back in the Ways and Means hearing room, although I'm used to sitting back there, but they won't let me do that anymore. So I just want to kind of touch on a few things that I think will help help the discussion, and then obviously we can go into questions. So, you know, one of the things that I was, you know, I've always been wondering about is, you know, as Brian pointed out, you know, quick to say, Congress has authority over foreign trade, Article 1, Section 8, and when you work on the Hill, particularly in a trade area, that is one of the things that is ingrained in your brain from day one, Article 1, Section 8, that's your answer. But, you know, the question is, well, why? You know, why did the founders, why did they do that? And I think, you know, most likely it's because really for the first 120 years of our history, you know, trade policy was really domestic policy. The point of trade policy was tariffs, and the point of the tariffs were for domestic reasons. Number one, raising revenue. You know, tariffs were the United States' number one source, the United States government number one source of revenue, pretty much up until the income tax was established. Tariffs were a form of protecting U.S. industry. Again, domestic economic policy. And then also, you know, if you look back in arguments for the various tariffs, there is talk about, you know, the need to protect U.S. workers against unfair competition against low-paid foreign workers. So, you know, even back in the day of the sailing ship and the steamship, there was a lot of that concern, and that was a real main focus of trade policy. So it was a very domestic policy-oriented debate. And you know, if you look back, and pretty much the only reference that could be found regarding why Congress has this power in the Federalist Papers was in number 53, since this is a Federalist Society event, I thought it'd be good to look back at that. And apparently, well, it's suspected that Madison wrote it, but basically, you know, he said that, you know, Congress has this power because Congress best knows the economic diversity and issues of all the states and all the districts, unlike the president, who is removed from it all. It's, you know, each member of Congress knows their district. They know the economic issues of their district and of the port and of their ways and interests and things like that. And so you need the body that has that collective knowledge and that you know, frankly, is also subject to that collective influence to determine trade policy versus an executive branch where it's just one person representing, being elected by all the people. But then, you know, we see, you know, with the issue of Congress's role starting to be modified and the president's role increasing with that, you know, you're seeing that in the context of a change in the role of trade policy, a change from it being almost purely a domestic policy type issue to one that reflects a overall policy goal of liberalization that was mostly adopted, you know, from the 30s onward, that trade liberalization, getting rid of barriers to trade, be it tariffs or non-tariff barriers, I'll talk about in a little bit, is overall a good thing and overall should be the driving goal of trade policy. And then also the view of trade policy being an arm of foreign policy. Again, probably stemming a lot from, you know, the view that the Depression, made worse by the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and the various other tariffs that other countries put in place, helped kind of lay the foundation for World War II. And, you know, right after World War II, or as World War II is wrapping up, you know, there's the Bretton Woods Agreement. You know, let's create these various international institutions that will help prevent the conditions that led to World War II. So you had the World Bank, the IMF, and you had an international trade organization that was, you know, there was a treaty, the Havana Treaty, establishing it in the 40s, but Congress did not pass it. As an interesting little historical aside, it kind of devolved in what it was the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT, which was the main kind of international institution. And President Truman entered the GATT under the authority of the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act with no congressional approval. He just went ahead and joined it, which is, I think is an interesting thing. Another little footnote is that the whole argument about, well, increased trade will help prevent wars. Don't forget, right before World War I, Germany and the United Kingdom were huge trading partners with each other, but that didn't quite prevent World War I from happening. But anyway, so you had this shift of the focus of the goals of trade policy away from revenue and kind of domestic economic promotion to a, you know, more broader economic goal of liberalization, and then with that, foreign affairs. So it kind of, you know, with that in mind, at least on a substantive basis, putting aside the constitutional issues, you can see why it would shift more to the president. And that, as Brian had pointed out, this kind of kept on going on as the years went by. Now, you know, Congress did kind of try to fight back a little bit, as, you know, they didn't approve the Kennedy round of negotiations. They would only give, up until the 74 Act, authority to the president on tariffs, not non-tariff barriers. And, you know, I think, you know, there's also the view that in some ways the negotiations were getting too captured by foreign affairs concerns. So Congress basically told the State Department, who was running all the trade negotiations until the early 60s, they basically kicked them out, created this new office within the White House called the Special Trade Representative, now known as the U.S. Trade Representative, to be the front point on trade policy and trade negotiations for the United States. And, you know, on non-tariff barriers, although they, you know, Congress agreed in the 74 Act to give the president authority to negotiate on those, I mean, I think that's going forward has been one of the areas that has created the most controversy, as Daniel pointed out, because in non-tariff barriers, you know, your non-tariff, you know, what looks like to me as a non-tariff barrier to you is a legitimate exercise of domestic policy for, you know, food safety purposes, consumer protection purposes, environmental purposes, whatever. So here you have a real interjection again of trade policy into the domestic policy sphere. So now we're even going beyond Article 1, Section 8. We're going into all the other areas that Congress has jurisdiction over per the Constitution. So, you know, you had this dynamic, both a political dynamic, a policy dynamic, and a constitutional dynamic. And I think it's reflected as, if you look at all the different versions of Fast Track and then TPA over time, and you compare them, you know, basically with each TPA, Congress kind of fights the last war in trying to tweak it, tighten it, try to respond to problems that it observed leading up to that time. So if you look at the act that passed in 2015, you'll see that probably, you know, I mean, it's kind of the most, you know, restrictive or prescriptive as far as what needs to be done to have, to get, for the bill, the implementing bill to have TPA protection up here in Congress. So you have the you have the objectives that are set out in the TPA 2015 include far more objectives than they have in the past. You have far more detailed objectives. You have things like digital trade being added in. You have a whole new, as I worked on it, a whole new section. I mean, the ag objectives have always been long, but they got even longer and more detailed on sanitary, phytosanitary standards of again, food safety, animal, human health, and plant safety issues. You have stricter reporting and consultation requirements where upon request, the USTR must meet with any member of Congress to talk about negotiations. It lays out the fact that members of Congress shall have access to the negotiating text. Again, this is a reflection of some, particularly during the negotiations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, of many members of Congress feeling that they didn't know what was going on, and that the prior administration was not being fully forthright in allowing them to have and be able to see what to have a role. So that was put in, along with the requirement that members, and then later on in another bill, certain staff would be accredited as part of the U.S. negotiating team. Although I will just, from what I understand, even though that's law, even the current administration has not done a very good job in living up to that requirement. The 2015 Act put in, they limited, basically a limitation to the implementing bill that it may only contain provisions that are strictly necessary or appropriate to implement the agreement. Concerns about the administration sticking in to the implementing bill, things that may be a little bit related to implementing the agreement, but not, but then kind of forcing Congress saying, look, you got to pass the bill, including this other stuff, if you want to get this agreement or not. So they put that limitation in. And then also about Congress's ability to revoke TPA procedures, both through a procedural disapproval resolution, which has to go through both houses, or a consultation and compliance resolution, which can come out of either house. But one thing that I think has to be kept in mind about TPA, and this is kind of the dirty secret is the right word about TPA, but there's a lot of a lot has been said in critiquing TPA, saying that Congress is giving up its constitutional authority to the president. And the interesting thing about TPA is at the end of the day is TPA really is if the Congress, if the president meets certain requirements, is notification, consultation, having meeting certain objectives, things like that, Congress, if it wants to, can follow these constrained procedures as far as setting time limits on how long Congress would consider the bill and act upon it, and then also avoiding amendments. So really, the heart of TPA is our suggested rules for the House and for the Senate. And there is no TPA jail, and there's no TPA judge. The Congress, the other house of the Congress, can say, you know what, President, you followed every single requirement of TPA to the nth degree. It is the most perfect following of TPA ever possible by a human being or administration. But guess what? We're not going to follow TPA. And they can do it, and it's been done. Speaker Pelosi did it when the Columbia FTA was sent up by President Bush. So it is really kind of a one-way street in some ways for the executive branch, because the president, no matter how good of a job the president does in following TPA, there is no absolute guarantee at the end of the day that Congress has to follow TPA. And I think that's something that, as we have the USMCA, if that gets considered in the next Congress, and as the administration tries to navigate the Hill, and particularly if the House changes to Democratic majority, that's something they need to keep. I would say they would need to keep in mind. And finally, on the issue, there is the issue of withdrawal, and I think, the next, as I said, each TPA tends to fight the last war. The next TPA, I'm pretty positive, will have pretty explicit language about withdrawal from agreements and how that can be done and who can do it like that. But we do have between now and then the issue, open issue of the president has talked about withdrawing from NAFTA. It's very possible the president can send up the the USMCA and say, well, Congress, if you don't like it, fine, but I'm going to withdraw from NAFTA, so it's either nothing or USMCA. What are you going to do about it? And I think, you know, first of all, anybody who says they have the definitive answer on that question is lying, because it's a very complex issue. It's an issue of statutory interpretation, interpreting the NAFTA implementing legislation. You know, I've kind of looked at it and tried to work my way through it, and I come up with different answers each time. There is language in the 74 Act that applies, and then there's the constitutional issue. And I think, you know, an interesting constitutional issue is the president has the ability to withdraw from an agreement and essentially nullify the implementing bill. Is the president in a way legislating and therefore acting, not having that constitutional authority to do so? Or if the bill, implementing bill, gives the president that authority, is that an improper delegation of authority by Congress? So I think with that, I will stop so we can go to questions.
Thank you. Before we go to audience questions, I'd like to open it up to our panel to see if they have any responses or discussion.
Yeah, in response to something Daniel talked about, I almost got the sense there's no question part of this construct, at least back in the 30s, was this idea that we wanted policy of the United States to be pro-trade, right? We wanted it to be, pro-engagement. But I guess in my comments, when I talk about the trade policy it's really a kind of an ongoing, constant negotiation and struggle between the Congress and the executive branch, as I think is the case with many different issues. I don't have a normative assessment. You know, I'm not saying the outcome should be that we want to make it easier to enter into free trade agreements. I actually don't think it is. That would be my personal preference from policy. But I actually think, frankly, if the legislative process in giving Congress or having Congress take more of this authority back would make it harder to pass trade agreements, actually, I think that's not necessarily a terrible thing. And I think, you know, I also don't think it is Congress kind of giving up its role and impugning democratic values in the United States because members can't vote on these individual articles. Of course, members vote on the entire agreement. That's how they exercise their democratic rights. And, you know, not unlike any kind of long bill with lots of different issues in it, members may or may not have had direct influence on any specific issue. So no setup, I think, is perfect. I actually think the way this negotiation that happens and changes over time, and I don't mean negotiation specifically, I mean kind of just the way the legislative branch deals with the executive branch on these issues. Steve noted the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, or Trade Promotion Agreement, or whatever the hell we called it back then, 2008. Speaker Pelosi did stop the clock on TPA, which is the ultimate Trump card, truly, no pun intended. For Congress on these trade matters, and the administration needs to be cognizant of that. So it's a kind of an ongoing poker game of chicken that I think actually works well in our democratic constitutional structure.
Well, but as we'd heard, I mean, there was a political ideological decision made by policymakers to embrace a rather large vision of liberalization worldwide. And you've seen that, you know, that was accepted by the American public for a very long time. Based on the way political debates have fallen out over the last several years, particularly with the election of Donald Trump, but not just that, also with, you know, any number of phenomena that we've seen among the Democrats and elsewhere, that there really has been this sense among the American public that they have had their government commit them to policies that went beyond what they were willing to authorize, and that there hadn't been the degree of deliberation that the public would like to have. Now, this is a matter of public perception. Maybe the public perception is incorrect, but legitimacy itself is a matter of perception. It's not just a matter, I think, you know, we tend to think of it in terms of simply following rules and checking the right boxes. But ultimately, if the people themselves feel as if they have been excluded and their concerns have been quashed, that's a problem. And I recall, you know, very well from the debates 20 years ago and even more recently over you know, various trade issues, some of which were not trade agreement issues, but were rather the question of sort of most favored nation, for example, and giving that to China on a regular basis. But these were highly polarizing debates, and the tendency among supporters of free trade at the time was, we need to depoliticize this. We need to make this as anodyne as possible, make it as administrative as possible, and generally get people to sort of swallow the pill without questioning what's in it. Presenting it that way may sound polemical. It's not polemical. There is, in fact, you know, there are good faith reasons, there are necessary reasons why trade negotiations are conducted the way they are conducted, that you do have to deal with you know, both your domestic political constituencies and also with foreign governments, which want to know what they're dealing with, right? They don't want to have a constantly changing set of demands being made by, you know, multiple sources of negotiation. They want to have one source with whom they can, you know, work out a streamlined process. But to acknowledge this, to say that there are good faith reasons for having this sort of blend of executive and legislative power, doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't still a fundamental problem here. It's a problem in the very nature of the thing, which is that it is, in effect, international legislation. And international legislation will never have the degree of legitimacy that regular national legislation has. When it comes to treaties, we see there's a conscious trade-off in the U.S. Constitution. Treaties don't involve the degree of democratic deliberation that you get with domestic legislation, but as a trade-off, instead, we have a two-thirds majority required for ratification. So you have a trade-off of a supermajority to legitimize a treaty in place of having the degree of deliberation that you would otherwise have. When it comes to the way in which trade agreements are pursued, which is through executive congressional agreements rather than treaties, you see that that supermajority requirement isn't there, and yet you also don't have the same degree of openness, transparency, and deliberation that you get with domestic legislation. And as Stephen had mentioned, I mean, one of the points of contention in all of these policies for many years has been how much transparency there is. First of all, are congresspeople themselves allowed to see these treaties, these agreements rather, as they're being negotiated? And second of all, to what extent is the American public allowed to see the text of these agreements as they're being negotiated or even when they're being presented for votes? I think there's a problem here of democratic accountability and participation and deliberation that goes even beyond the sort of technicalities of the policies themselves.
Well, since I talked last, I basically kind of responded to what I had already heard. I would just say that, look, it's tough because you do have very very legitimate small d democratic concerns in the formulation of trade policy versus the versus the mechanics of having to successfully have a trade negotiation that achieves your negotiations your objectives. So I mean, and that's why on one hand I'm very sympathetic from some who say, well, look, you know, you're setting domestic policy here through these negotiations. There should be a greater role. And you know, now you even, I mean, I get just my own observations. You have agencies that aren't, you know, usually, you know, the main agencies on trade, USTR, Commerce, Treasury, USDA. But then you get other people involved, you have EPA and HHS and others who, you know, they're regulators. You know, the one thing, you know, I'm kind of getting off, you know, one thing regulators don't like being told is how to regulate. and also to be told that the way they regulate might not be the best way of doing it. But anyway, so you get, you know, they want to get involved within the interagency process, and then, you know, the various groups that who they kind of interact with want to get involved too. But on the other hand, you know, you cannot do a negotiation out in the open. And, you know, so everyone who, you know, the people who complain all the negotiations should be open. And I like to say, well, so when you negotiated for your house or for your car or for whatever, were those out in the open too? They weren't? Well, why not? Because it's you can't get beyond the very nature of a negotiation having to have some confidentiality for it to work. So I'll stop there.
All right, I think we'll open it to audience questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Question is mainly for Brian, because it occurred to me while he was speaking, but for anyone else. If we have a Democratic majority next year, do you think that that majority will be willing to identify itself strongly with free trade policies if it's facing an administration that is hanging on to tariffs? Would free trade be an identity that the Democratic Party would take on?
Yeah, you know, to my great chagrin, my party, which started in the 30s, of course, conceived and wrote the Reciprocal Trade Agreements Act and was largely the bulwark for, you know, pro-trade, pro-growth policies for so many years, has really shifted the other way. And I'd say the parties have really, you know, I could talk about the history of why that's the case, but nevertheless, it's the case. I don't think of a Democratic majority in the House as being one that's going to be, you know, a big free trade party. Frankly, it wasn't that way back when Clinton was president either. And I think that's a function of who are the constituencies that, you know, Democratic members are responsive to. That doesn't mean, though, that, say, USMCA is dead on arrival in a House that's led by Speaker Pelosi or some other Democrat. I think there are, and we can talk afterwards why, but I think their prospects are actually fairly good for the USMCA, assuming that the steel and aluminum issues don't, you know, tank it before we even get there. So.
Hi, I'd like to ask a little bit more about the politics and congressional politics of all this. I just read Karl Rove's book on William McKinley's election, and McKinley was in the House before running for president and made the biggest plank of his platform was tariffs, a giant tariffs bill that he put together to protect various industries in the US. And he pulled the Republican Party along with him on this issue. Many of them were resistant. But he made this his biggest plank, ran on it, and won. And so back then, Congress had he did this through a brilliant legislative maneuvering and putting together a bipartisan coalition to do it too. But we don't have anything like that these days. So I'm wondering if members, if Congress is it doesn't have the same equities and can't claim as many wins from any one negotiation, and so they're like more hesitant to get behind it.
Well, first of all, I'll point out that McKinley was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, so one of the many chairmen of the Ways and Means Committee to become president. So yes, I mean, I think, do you have the situation now as you had then? I mean, you don't have the same situation now as you had then, right? Of where a member of Congress can or members together can really pull trade policy one way or another, just because of the way things have changed and how policy is determined. Yeah, but I think, you know, do they have equities? I mean, they definitely have equities, and they definitely seek to have those equities acted upon, and you know, in some places with great success. I mean, there are issues, and during the TPP negotiations where, You know, in talking with the last administration, you know, Chairman Brady, Speaker Ryan, others had basically said, you know, administration came up, so this is what we're thinking about doing, this is where we think things are going, and, you know, and they basically said that would be a really, really bad idea. And now the administration went ahead and on some of them anyway, and I think personally that's why, one of the reasons why TPP had problems. But there are other things that they did change. I mean, they were responsive to Congress, responsive to members of Congress of the opposite party, just as I'm sure they were to folks over in the Senate also. Members also, they stake out areas of expertise. Some really love, Chairman Hatch loves IP. He loves strong IP protection. And, so that's a huge equity for him, and he made that equity known in TPP and USMCA, and I think, had an influence on both negotiations. But even less senior members can stake out issues in areas and kind of be experts in them and have impact. And maybe not as much of an impact as they'd like, certainly not as much impact as McKinley had back in the day. But there is influence.
I would just add that trade policy tends to be a function of a larger economic and strategic paradigm. Having a leader like McKinley who's able to go farther perhaps than others, he's still part of a broad intellectual milieu in which tariffs were seen as not only important for revenue but were had been vital to the advancement of American industry over the course of the 19th century and then into the 20th. Subsequently, you had a U.S. which, for strategic reasons, largely involving the Cold War, and also as Stephen had mentioned, the feeling after World War II that international institutions would be a very good way of preventing further conflagrations like the First and Second World Wars. All of these things factored into the willingness of Congress to pursue the kinds of free trade policies and the methods of obtaining free trade policies that we saw over the course of the last several decades. And the thing is that we now seem to have reached a kind of historical turning point where just as Stephen had mentioned, there's a tendency for each agreement to be fighting the last war in terms of what was controversial about the previous agreement, what was controversial about trade issues in the years leading up to an agreement. There's a tendency overall for our trade policy to be a little bit lagging in terms of policymakers themselves, lagging in terms of popular sentiment and in terms of the developing sort of paradigm of the world. So, I mean, the strategic and economic concerns that I think Americans are most interested in right now have to do with the rise of China. They have to do with a feeling that America's best days might be behind it unless we take new policies, unless we actively abandon the sort of free trade regime that we've had for the last several decades. Now, they could be wrong about that. That sentiment might be misplaced. But I think that so far, Congress and our political process in general have had a hard time engaging in a kind of conscious deliberation and a seeking of compromise of these different sort of perspectives. And instead, we've had this sharp polarization between President Trump, who's really speaking for a lot of people whose voices had either been excluded or who felt their voices had been excluded, and we still have a sort of policy leadership on much of Capitol Hill and certainly outside of Capitol Hill in think tanks, especially Republican think tanks, which is still very much fixated on the trade regime of the past several decades. And that's a misfit. There needs to be a degree of openness and negotiation here and a returning to kind of what are the first principles, what are the interests we need to serve, and what are the sort of clashing perspectives that have to be satisfied before we can move forward. There's a need to reopen all of those questions that have been closed for many decades. And there's a reluctance, I think, to doing that. I think there's a reluctance to addressing just how unsettled all these questions presently are. And Congress really would be the optimal place, I think, to have these discussions. But I think it's extremely unlikely, given the nature of political debate in Congress, not only between the parties, but also even within them right now.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Brian Riley from the National Taxpayers Union. It's been a really interesting panel. I appreciate the Federalist Society for convening it. And your panel wrapped up, and correct me if I'm wrong, with the comment that nobody can really say whether the president has the authority to withdraw from a trade agreement or not. Can anybody say, or would you care to speculate or explain, in a scenario where President Trump says, I'm pulling out of NAFTA, and a member of Congress or senator says, no, you don't have authority, then what happens? Are we in a long-term back and forth legal battle, or could or would the Supreme Court step in to try and clarify that pretty quickly, or is that just uncharted territory? Thank you.
I mean, there's been a lot of chatter about this, various types of lawsuits. There's a lawsuit, you know, challenging some of the steel aluminum tariffs. There is a lawsuit brewing challenging, I think, some of the latter lists in the Section 301 tariffs. There are various legal avenues that are being discussed. There have been talks about, well, who would sue if the president chose to seek to withdraw from NAFTA, or what would happen? You know, could he almost certainly withdraw from the agreement itself, but what is the impact domestically? What does that do to the laws that were passed as part of the implementing text that require this kind of international architecture? It is a super complicated question. I don't know if Congress could bring suit. My guess is that would probably be a political question. But, you know, could a downstream consumer, somebody who's impacted by it, could an industry participant, could they sue the president? I just don't know, in some sort of constitutional argument. It's a fascinating question, it really is. And boy, I hope we don't get to that point, Brian.
I might be a little bit more forward-leaning than Brian. I think whether a member of Congress would have standing to sue the president is an open question. But whether some U.S. private party who feels that they're being negatively impacted would have standing, I think they would. The most certain thing, if the president were to withdraw from NAFTA, is litigation. And there are ways of having to go directly from the lower court to the Supreme Court, including the administration itself seeking ways of seeking to do that, which this Department of Justice has done in a number of areas, ongoing lawsuits on immigration and things like that. They've asked for to go immediately to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has to agree to it, and the Supreme Court has agreed to some of those requests. So I would imagine that it would probably get to the Supreme Court pretty quick. Whether or not there is some kind of injunction in the meantime would be interesting. I could see good arguments for an injunction, but good arguments against an injunction. So it's not going to, I wouldn't imagine, be a multi-year process. It would be as things go, rather quick.
This is kind of along the same lines of what we've been talking about, but what are your thoughts on the current case in the Court of International Trade and the delegation argument on the use of Section 232 tariffs?
I haven't really delved into the specifics of it. I'm quite skeptical. I think the courts are going to be reluctant to pass judgment on the exercise of national security powers by the president. But that's just a guess. I haven't done any kind of analysis.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's an interesting argument. It's not an argument that is often, you come across being made. But also, agree with Brian. Once you get into national security, the courts just kind of get skittish and highly deferential. So we'll see.
I mean, it does raise an interesting question, though, right? Because there are indicia that, well, maybe this isn't a pure national security exercise. I don't think the courts are going to go there, even on that. But, what if you, just hypothetically, you had a president who said, this is not at all about national security, but it gives me the authority to do this. you know, would a court step in that kind of a circumstance? That's not what we have here, but that would be a much more sort of interesting question if it was just very clearly an exercise of you know, domestic protectionism and not in the course of national security.
My question is about USMCA. We've alluded to the fact that the House might flip, and we know that Ambassador Lighthizer has tried to make the agreement be one that would appeal to pro-union Democrats. How much room would the House have to put their thumbprint on the agreement without having to go back to the negotiating table? How much can they do in implementing legislation that would make them feel like this is their baby too? Thank you.
Sorry, I'm like talking too much. I think there are things they can do, implementing text to interpret the agreement. They can kind of put guardrails around some of the things the president can do. But I would encourage you to think more broadly. You don't necessarily need to open up the agreement. You can have separate agreements. You could do side letters. We have opened up agreement. There's actually quite a lot of history of renegotiating agreements after they've been finalized and gone through, you know, a lot of this TPA process. But I think, for me, the more interesting question is, politically, are the Democrats going to want to try to reopen USMCA? There's a little bit, as you allude to, the Ambassador Lighthizer has made a pretty good effort to consult with some of the more typical trade skeptics on Capitol Hill, with some of the union groups. And I think labor leaders have been measured in their statements and actually leaving open the prospect of supporting the agreement. I actually think there's a decent prospect a few of these will end up at least mildly supporting the agreement. But environmental groups are not happy at all. And you end up with this blue-green divide, which is a nightmare for any kind of Democratic leader in the caucus, never mind all the other voices that are going to be on various Democratic constituencies arguing for changes in the agreement. And I think it also puts up the interesting prospect of the president, and Steve, you talked about how the president may sort of withdraw as a means to force this binary choice. You know, I hesitate to say this in this audience since I am a Democrat, but you know, I actually think the smarter political move for the president might be not to withdraw from NAFTA and to go to the industrial Midwest and say, hey, listen, you know, auto workers in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, I've negotiated an agreement that levels the playing field with Mexico, and the Democrats don't want to pass it. I've negotiated an agreement that cuts down on currency cheats like China. The Democrats don't want to do it. Kind of force the Democrats to be in a position of defending NAFTA, this agreement that they've criticized for a quarter of a century, right? Like, it's very awkward. So I think I, and there are other, I know, Democratic voices who are, you know, encouraging the Democrats, should they take the House, not to kind of open this Pandora's box and actually, you know, think about passing it pretty quickly. But I don't know that Democrats have made up their mind how this is going to go. They very well could end up opening up, as they did, you know, as I'm sure you know the Peru, Panama, Colombia, Korea back in 2007, the last time if the Democrats take over, it would have been the last time that they'd taken over. So very complex, confusing, shifting dynamics. And we'll just have to see what the election brings.
All right, I'd like to thank our panelists and...
Steve, Dan, Brian, Molly, thank you very much for your time and expertise. We're looking forward to continuing this discussion as we go forward and having you back again sometime soon. Thank you all for attending. One last housekeeping note on your way out. I don't know if you heard there was an evacuation in Cannon. I've got some texts from people who said that they were coming, but they can't make it. So your parting gift, if you'd like, is to take a lunch with you or take one for one of someone you work with. But thank you for coming, and I hope to see you again soon.